The term genocide is used for the deliberate extermination of a targeted group of people, whether for political, racial, economic, or other social reasons. A key word here is deliberate. To be precise in calling a massive loss of life genocide, the deaths must have been intentional, which differentiates genocide from other types of mass fatalities, whether natural or even man-made. So, for example, the tremendous number of Native Americans who died during the colonization of North America would technically not be considered genocide, since the vast majority lost their lives to European diseases, not European warfare. That doesn't deny how terrible and world-altering the decimation of the Native American population was, especially to an anthropologist like me. It's simply to say that the precise definition of genocide doesn't apply to the bulk of the lives lost, since contagion wasn't well understood at the time, and the deaths from disease weren't intentional. A specific event, however, like the approximately 4,000 Cherokee who died during the Trail of Tears migration between Florida and Oklahoma in the 1830s, well, that is genocide, because the U.S. government forced the relocation, and there was every reason to believe that many would not survive that journey. There have been so many tragic examples of genocide throughout world history. Here's just a few major events from only the 20th century alone. The Turks decimated as many as 2 million Armenians throughout and after World War I, during which some say the first organized concentration camps were used. Shortly after that, in the USSR, about 20 million died at the hands of Joseph Stalin. His failed socialist agricultural projects caused great famines in the new Soviet nation. Stalin's regime targeted former Russian military and the upper echelon of Russian society, including a variety of, quote, enemies of the people. Likewise, the agricultural, industrial, and social changes of the so-called Great Leap Forward of China's Mao Zedong led to mass death from starvation throughout the Chinese countryside in the late 1950s and early 60s. Mao's cultural revolution that followed caused the imprisonment or murder of anyone believed to be against the government. Some estimate 50 to 70 million people were killed in China between 1949 and 1976. Now the intent comes into play in both Stalin's and Mao's agricultural genocides because the practices continued despite the knowledge that so many people were dying from them. Probably the most well-known genocide came at the hands of the German Nazis, who killed about two-thirds of Europe's Jews in the 12-year Holocaust between 1933 and 1945. Others targeted include Jehovah's Witnesses, Roma and Polish people, Russian prisoners of war, homosexuals, and those who were mentally or physically handicapped. Total estimates are that 11 million people died, mostly by poison gas administered in Third Reich death camps. No one really knows the number of people who've died in North Korean prison camps since 1945. Or from the long-standing practice of refusing or diverting aid from starving Korean peasants, which many believe is still happening today. And in just the 3 years of 1975 to 1978, the killing fields of Cambodia resulted in about 2.2 million, that's over 20% of the country's population being exterminated by Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge. Victims were minority ethnic and religious groups, as well as intellectuals and the professional class. The Kurdish genocide in northern Iraq that occurred in the late 80s under Saddam Hussein and his cousin known as Chemical Ali killed almost 200,000 people, including other minority groups in the region. And the Hutu killing spree in Rwanda, which happened over only 100 days in 1994, left somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million of the Tutsi people dead, while the United Nations pulled out their troops and abandoned the country. Unbelievably, this long list is just a small sample. At the time I was writing this lecture, mass graves were being discovered in other parts of Africa and in Syria. Now, let's talk about how human rights groups locate genocide graves and use the evidence found in them to understand critical details about the atrocities committed and help prosecute those responsible. According to the United Nations, a mass grave contains three or more executed people, but obviously could contain many more. In addition, these genocides can involve a tremendous number of separate burial locations. For example, in Cambodia, mapping teams have already identified over 20,000 grave sites from the Khmer Rouge's three-year killing spree. The systematic archaeological excavation of mass graves and the forensic analyses of the remains and artifacts in them are evidence of crimes against humanity. But I can tell you, locating a clandestine grave can be like trying to find a needle in a haystack. The memories of witnesses fade and the topography changes over time. So forensic scientists have developed new techniques or adopted existing ones to help find the graves of genocide before they're forever lost to time. Scientists, like those working with the forensic arm of Physicians for Human Rights and the International Commission on Missing Persons, have used techniques like ground-penetrating radar to look for subsurface disturbances. Using this method, radio waves reflected in the soil are picked up by an antenna to help detect underground anomalies. This can potentially even show where bodies were after they've been removed, as was a common practice after the Bosnian War. The bad guys would move remains once they thought investigators were closing in on the graves. But ground-penetrating radar has to be used on the surface. So since about 2005, forensic investigators have also used before and after satellite images to try to find evidence for mass graves from the air. That's only effective, though, for graves with hundreds of bodies in them, not smaller graves of, say, 10 people, which are far more common, especially in recent genocides. In early 2013, some of my forensic anthropology friends from the University of Tennessee's Anthropology Research Facility, commonly called the Body Farm, began a project with the goal of learning more about identifying mass burials. The researchers excavated four holes along a lake at Fort Loudoun State Park and then buried 10 donated human bodies. One site was filled back in with only soil to serve as an experimental control. Into a second hole, a single body was placed. Three bodies were buried in the third grave, and the other six corpses were literally piled into the fourth pit. Bullets and shell casings were also placed into some of the graves, as well as personal effects like wallets. Their plan is to monitor the burials over the course of 3 years to look for surface changes, but also to use a variety of non-invasive methods, so-called remote sensing techniques, to look at what's going on inside the grave. One is LIDAR technology. That stands for light detection and ranging, where lasers are used to map an area's surface topography. Now, that's because burials typically start as a mound, but become a depression as the soft tissues of the bodies decay. The other technique is multispectral imagery, which monitors different wavelengths of light as they bounce off the ground's surface, including those outside the range visible to humans, like infrared. This can show soil and vegetation changes that occur after a grave is constructed and nature starts to fill back in. But the project is even more multidisciplinary, especially at ground level. Entomologists have been brought on board to look at insect succession, botanists will study plant changes, soil experts will analyze chemical isotopes, and molecular genetics researchers will examine whether bodies in the multiple graves can contaminate one another's DNA profiles. The scientists completed baseline studies of the plant, soil, and topography before they dug the graves for comparison to anticipated changes. At the conclusion of the project, they're going to bring in international human rights anthropologists. They'll be invited to a week-long workshop to learn how to properly excavate mass graves. From the data collected during the study, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory will try to generate computer models and algorithms. They're hoping that some combination of the techniques used and the information gained will ultimately provide a faster, more definite, and safer way of locating mass graves from genocide, maybe using drones. But the methods could also be helpful in any other type of forensic situation where a clandestine grave is suspected, like even one of my own cases. Having the research project last 3 years will give a sense of how time alters the graves and their contents. That way, even if forensic archaeologists and anthropologists can't get to genocide graves immediately, say due to dangerous conflict that's still going on in the area, sites can be marked on satellite-generated maps, and images can be continuously monitored until it's safe to go in. All in all, this high-tech University of Tennessee study might prove invaluable when forensic teams are called upon to locate and exhume mass graves. Now, I want to tell you about some fairly low-tech but very personal experiences I've had learning about mass graves and genocide. In the 36 years between 1960 and 1996, over 200,000 people were murdered in Guatemala. Most of them died at the hands of their own government. The majority were of Mayan descent. They were victims caught in a political crossfire between ruthless government military forces and Marxist guerrilla rebels who sought to overthrow the corrupt administration. This genocide was mostly about race and land use, and the bulk of the killings occurred in the highlands where the majority of Mayans live, having been driven there centuries ago by the Spanish conquest. In addition to the suffering and loss of the Mayan people, some non-Mayan citizens, particularly Latinos of high socioeconomic status, who held anti-government views, also quietly disappeared during that time. The majority of these desaparecidos, as those who simply disappeared are called, were from the city centers and universities, mainly college faculty, students, and others who sought political reform. The fate of nearly all these victims is still unknown. Guatemala sits at the north end of Central America, beneath the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. Its modern capital, Guatemala City, is just a few hours by plane from Cincinnati. In the summer of 2004, as part of a television project for the National Geographic Channel, I was invited to observe and participate in the work of human rights anthropologists in Guatemala, including forensic anthropologists, social anthropologists, and archaeologists. Much of our work took place in and around Guatemala City, extending up into the mountains, into the northwest, near the town of Chichicastenango, at elevations up to nearly 9,000 feet above sea level. In Guatemala City, I was picked up at the airport to be taken to the laboratory of the Guatemalan Forensic Anthropology Foundation, known as the FAFG. During this drive through the city, I was in a vehicle with tinted windows and told by my armed driver that I needed to stay close by him for my protection. Not only because I was a female traveling alone in a strange country, but because the anthropologists working to resolve these murders had received many death threats. On the outskirts of Guatemala City, we reached the walled, gated, and heavily guarded entrance of the laboratory. The foundation's offices and lab were in a renovated house, the former Japanese ambassador's home, I believe. There were small wooden coffins the size that would be used for baby burials lining its hallways as testimony to the foundation's work. Now, these are used to house the decomposed remains of victims that are exhumed from mass graves by the archaeologists, since fragmentary skeletons don't require adult-sized caskets. After graves are exhumed, the remains are brought to the lab where anthropologists attempt to identify the dead and document injuries observed on the bones in the hopes of using that information to prosecute war crimes. The director of the foundation, Freddie Peccarelli, told me, quote, "The main mission of the foundation is to provide dignity to the family members through the identification of the bodies and also create a scientific historical record," end quote. But just as importantly, the foundation operates to document to the world in a scientific and public way that these events did happen in Guatemala's recent history, and that the people who died mattered to each other and to the past, present, and future of Guatemala. in essence, that they are not forgotten. The roots of the foundation predate 1996, when the United Nations brokered a peace accord and created a commission to investigate the human rights violations in Guatemala. Even before that time, a core group of anthropologists was already secretly investigating the atrocities at great danger to themselves. In the early 90s, my dear departed friend, the famous Dr. Clyde Snow from Oklahoma, retired from academia and began making trips to Central and Latin America to train local anthropologists in this kind of work. Clyde, who died in May of 2014, was one of the granddads of forensic anthropology and the virtual founder of human rights anthropology. His Guatemalan team began with a staff of five, and when I visited in 2004, the FAFG had about 60 staff members. Some worked in the offices, others studied remains in the laboratory, and still more worked in the field, interviewing witnesses or locating and excavating graves. In the lab, scientists document wounds to the skeleton, which can often be corroborated by eyewitness accounts of the murders that are gathered by Foundation's social anthropologists. Gunshot wounds, like the one I saw on the back of a 62-year-old Mayan woman's skull, were the typical method of execution, but there were many others. One 15-year-old boy had 88 non-lethal machete wounds to his arms and legs, which probably caused him to bleed to death. To save ammunition, young children and babies were often killed by holding their legs and swinging them against trees or rocks to smash their skulls. There probably isn't a means of torture or murder that the anthropology team has not seen in one case or another. The horrors are almost unspeakable. Regarding the fieldwork, I should first point out that most of the Mayan victims in the Highland graves are known individuals. They were either executed alone or typically in small groups and had their bodies left to rot as an example to their family members and fellow villagers. Often the murderers did not permit the families to bury their dead. But typically within a day or two of the killings, after those responsible moved on, the family members snuck back to the scene to quickly and secretly bury their loved ones, usually deep in the woods in unmarked graves, and at the risk of being caught and killed themselves. So in many cases, the villagers often knew who died and when, where they're buried, and could actually lead the anthropologist to the graves. So you might wonder then why the dead would even be disturbed. Well, from a practical standpoint, if a woman buried her husband 20 years ago, there's no record of his death or the events surrounding it except in her memory. From a legal standpoint, no death certificate means she can't remarry, and unrecorded deaths mean children can't inherit land from their deceased parents. But from a humanitarian and psychological perspective, it's hugely important that the victims be reburied with a proper funeral ceremony so family members can bring final dignity to their dead. No one should be killed and then thrown out to rot like garbage before being hastily interred in a secret grave by fearful relatives. It's an essential part of the healing process to give names and proper burials to these dead. So then the first step in bringing the anthropology team in to assist has to be that the family members come forward and request help from the government. But when I was there, many were still very untrusting of the authorities. So trained social anthropologists, what some of us might call cultural anthropologists or even social workers, well, they go visit the villages to mediate the process and interview witnesses to these old crimes. In the village of Chuhulimul, near the town of Chichicastenango, I participated in one of these interviews with a middle-aged man named Don Diego. He told us that he and five other men, one of whom was his brother, were gathered outside the small store in their tiny village one afternoon. He said some guys from the army came by, and when they saw the six men gathered, assumed they were somehow conspiring against the government. So they chased the men into the woods, but Don Diego ran in a different direction. Then he heard gunshots from the forest, but he hid. The next day, he got some of the villagers, and they went into the woods and found the bodies of the five men, scattered among the trees and riddled with bullets. He had tears in his eyes as he told us the story, even though the incident happened 22 years before. He said he felt guilty for running away and sorry that he got to live his life while his friends and his brother didn't. The clandestine graves where Don Diego and other villagers buried the men were deep in the woods near the top of a mountain. It took us the better part of an afternoon to get up there. Near the end of the trip, we had to leave the vehicles and climb the steep slopes by foot. Now, local men had previously helped clear the sites in the woods where they knew the graves were. By the time I got there, foundation anthropologists had already uncovered two of the three burial sites that held Don Diego's brother and his friends. One of the graves contained two men, one of whom was probably only about 16 years old. The other grave in which I worked contained the remains of a man who was estimated to be in his mid-40s. The third grave was a short distance away and not yet opened. Now, over the years, I've worked at lots of crime scenes as a forensic anthropologist, but I never experienced anything like that. The family and friends of the dead men were all around the exhumation site. They talked softly, sang, some of them cried. Their little children, who weren't even alive when these awful things happened, were laughing and playing in the woods nearby. In the grave where I worked, we found the remains of a man. His wallet was buried with him. In it were some photographs, a small mirror and a comb, and a calendar and coins, all dated before 1982, when the burials had taken place. The wallet was passed around the crowd, and one woman began to sob and cry out, "Esta se llama Pedro Morales Morales, mi hermano." It was her brother who had gone to the store that day and been killed with his friends. 22 years ago, as a young girl, she had watched the villagers bury him at that site. The social anthropologists, who were also trained as grief counselors, tried to comfort her while we continued to excavate. When the clothing was cut away from the man's skeleton, we were able to see he had a gunshot wound that shattered the bone of his thigh, and another gunshot wound to his hand, which he had probably held up in defense. But the cause of death was obvious. He had a single gunshot wound to the side of his head. On another day, along with Dr. Clyde Snow, the foundation director Freddie Peccarelli, and Christina Illich from the United Nations, I visited another exhumation site. This site was in the village of Panamache, also near Chichicastenango, about 3 hours northwest of Guatemala City. It was high in the mountains. Some of the village women met us and led us, along with their sheep, up the mountain to the site. There were two graves at this location, both hidden in the cornfields, near the edge of the forest that surrounded the tiny community. As I walked past the first gravesite, I saw villagers watching the progress of some of the foundation anthropologists. I was assigned to a different team that went deeper into the cornfield to assist at the second burial site. The entire community was around the area. The village school had given the kids a holiday, and everybody else had suspended their work that day so they could see what the anthropologists were doing. The bodies in the grave where I worked had been covered with beautifully colored Mayan blankets when they were buried. Under the cloth covering, which had held up pretty well, you could easily see a row of three round mounds that looked like they were probably skulls. We pulled back the blanket and found the skull of the first person, who appeared to be an adult female. As we continued to peel the blanket away, we found the remains of two small children, one about 5 and the other one an infant. When they were buried, the youngest had been wrapped in the female's arms. She was probably the child's mother or grandmother. The importance of establishing the ages of these victims, as well as their identities, is to show that these were not enemy combatants. How can a 5-year-old child or an infant be considered harmful to the military? How could that 62-year-old woman I mentioned earlier have been a threat to a man with a high-powered rifle? These graves help establish to any court that there could be no legitimate purpose for the executions of the women and children in them. Unfortunately, though, even though the foundation had recovered some 3,000 sets of remains from over 400 sites, by the time I visited in 2004, there had only been 3 successful trials. Also at Panamache, I was surprised to see a group of uniformed school kids who had come a long way on a bus from a larger town. They had been brought by their history teacher to see the work of the anthropologist. As they quietly watched us uncovering the bones of the children in the grave, I wondered if those school kids considered, had they lived at another time, that could be them in that grave. These aren't just lessons for Guatemalan school children, but the rest of the world as well. In my memory, the conflicts in Guatemala had only been vague news stories during the time they happened. But I was shocked when one of our drivers, a man in his early 40s who grew up in Guatemala City, told me that even many people who lived in Guatemala at the time weren't aware of the genocide. He said if you were an upper or middle class teenager during those years, your parents protected you from the stories, not only to shield you from the horrors, but also because young boys would run off and join the guerrilla fighters out of what he called romantic notions, since the guerrillas live like bandits up in the mountains. But in many ways, the guerrilla fighters were no better than the military. A typical scenario was that the guerrillas would come through a village and ask for food, shelter, and clothing. If the Mayans refused, the guerrillas would kill them. But if the village cooperated and the government forces found out, the military would execute the whole village, or maybe just some as an example to the others. Loved ones were often made to watch and sometimes even forced to participate in the torture and killing of their family members. Eventually, though, due to the bravery of those who came forth and told their awful stories, graves have been exhumed, injuries have been documented, and identifications have been made. Following that, the bones of the dead can be bundled into those baby coffins I mentioned. The government can issue death certificates, and preparations can be made to return the remains to their families. I was privileged to attend one of the Foundation's repatriation ceremonies in the remote mountain town of Quetzal, where just over two decades before, a bloody confrontation between the army and guerrillas led to the mass murder of 20 villagers, mostly women, children, and the elderly. The journey to Quetzal was long and difficult. We traveled nearly 4 hours on dusty dirt roads, following a truck that held 10 coffins and several cardboard boxes of fragments that were too badly damaged for identification. As we neared the top of the mountain, we came upon a group of village women returning from their agricultural fields. The forensic anthropologist pulled the truck over so the women could ride in the back with the coffins on our way up to their town. The village center consisted of just two buildings, a one-room town hall and a one-room schoolhouse. The truck was unloaded and the caskets were carried into the town hall. Once we were inside, the anthropologist opened the containers so that the families could pay their last respects. The foundation had been able to identify 7 of the 10 dead, a mother, father, and their 2 sons, and a grandmother and her 2 grandsons. Without dental or medical records, and with DNA technology being too expensive at the time, the families have to content themselves with whatever results the foundation can provide. The remains were to be left all day for visitation, so flowers and candles were put on each casket, and they put fresh pine needles on the floor so the mourners would stir up the fragrances as they moved among the coffins. Local men were playing horns and drums, and we could hear the music as we got into our vehicles to leave that grieving village. Despite years of death threats to the foundation's anthropologists and their families, the work has continued and prospered. I remember telling Freddie, as strange as this sounds, that each and every one of those late-night threatening phone calls, or each time his vehicle had to be searched for a bomb, well, that was testament to the foundation's success. Those threats mean that the anthropologists have done such powerful work in identifying remains and documenting war crimes that those responsible were now running scared, afraid of being caught and made accountable for the awful things they had done. In early 2012, I emailed a note of congratulations to both Freddie Peccarelli and Clyde Snow when I heard that Efrain Rios Montt, a former general in the Guatemalan army, who became the country's de facto president during the worst of the atrocities, well, he was finally going to be tried for genocide and crimes against humanity. He was found guilty on May 10, 2013, and sentenced to 80 years. But just 10 days later, the decision was annulled on a technicality. What a disappointment for the people seeking justice, including the forensic anthropologists. A retrial has been set for January of 2015, but at that point, Montt will be 88 years old. Still, the work of human rights anthropology will continue in fields and in laboratories around the globe. We can only hope that groups like the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala and many others can find the graves of genocide, document the dead, and bring the perpetrators to justice. That might help some of the world's many war-torn countries to heal the deep wounds that scar their history and their people.